be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin, Senior Vice President of Global Strategic Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are entirely unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
This is Richard Martin again, Richard Martin's wake-up call, coming to you from Miami, Florida. Well, let's start with the news today. The U.S. government says a flood of economic stimulus payments pushed the federal budget deficit to an all-time high of $165.9 billion in May. The Treasury Department reported Wednesday that the May deficit was more than double the imbalance in May 2007. That reflects some $48 billion in payments as part of the government's $168 billion effort to give the economy a jump start and keep the country from falling into recession. For the first 8 months of the budget year, the deficit totals $319.4 billion, slightly below the all-time record for this period of $346 billion set in the 2004 budget year. Okay, keep the country from falling into recession. Well, I think that speaks for itself, really, doesn't it? What else? We have Citigroup, Merrill Lynch, and UBS may post losses of $10 billion on bond insurance after MBIA Inc. and Ambac Financial Group lost their top credit ratings, Oppenheimer analyst Meredith Whitney said. By the way, she's the new star on the street, and she is very good, and I strongly recommend listening to whatever she may happen to say. So you probably heard, ladies and gentlemen, MBIA and Ambac, which are the world's two largest bond insurers, had their AAA ratings cut two levels by Standard & Poor's on June the 5th, and that automatically trimmed the ratings on more than $1 trillion of securities that they guaranteed. And this is exactly what we had talked about, the fear that the ratings would be diminished, thereby sort of infecting all of the paper that they insured throughout the municipal bond world. She writes, Meredith Whitney writes, and I quote, "The downgrades may limit the so-called monoline insurer's ability to write new policies, putting further pressure on earnings. The limited earnings potential of monolines poses a risk to the value of the insurance and hedges on the subprime-related securities provided to the banks and brokers. The collateral damage could be in excess of an additional $10 billion. Well, this should come as no surprise to you, ladies and gentlemen. We've talked about this. We've discussed the ramifications, and they are not pretty. Okay, what else do we have? Those single-family new housing starts fell 42% year-over-year in April. There were still 32% more single-family homes built than sold in the month, and new home inventories are at a huge 10.6 months of supply. Traffic at home builder Toll Brothers for the quarter ending in April was, quote, the worst we've ever seen, said CEO Robert Dole. Toll Brothers reported yesterday that its backlog had fallen 50% year over year. Toll's average contracted home price plunged nearly 25% year over year in the period. This is the biggest housing collapse in this country's history, and it's happened before widespread job losses hit the economy. I cannot imagine how bad the housing market could get as these job losses mount. The government reported 100,000 lost jobs in the last 2 months, though, as we've discussed, these numbers are severely depressed by that ridiculous birth-death gimmickry. And we've spoken about that at length, so I think I don't need to go into that here again. Last month, the outplacement firm of Challenger, Gray & Christmas, reported that Wall Street had announced nearly 50,000 job cuts in the first 4 months of the year, nearly half coming in April alone. And the cuts just keep on coming, with lending down, stock market trading volume subsiding, IPO activity dormant, mergers sharply lower, and structured finance, you know, that's those CDOs and CLOs, etc., nearly obliterated. Challenger Gray & Christmas reported that there had been over 31,000 layoffs announced in the government sector this year, but here again, the pressure on government budgets has just begun to build. Last month, the U.S. Treasury Department reported that corporate income tax revenue over the first 7 months of the fiscal year plummeted 14.7% year over year. I was in the middle of reading you some information about the budgets, which I think I shall repeat for those of you who didn't get it. Challenger Gray & Christmas reported that there have been over 31,000 layoffs announced in the government sector this year, but here again, the pressure on government budgets has just begun to build. Last month, the U.S. Treasury Department reported that corporate income tax revenue over the first 7 months of the fiscal year plummeted 14.7% year over year. Government outlays jumped 7.3%, and the deficit soared 88% year over year. This deterioration in the government's finances occurred before the $160 billion in tax rebate giveaways that began last month. Though the Congressional Budget Office estimates a $400 billion budget deficit this year, that number will surely be sharply revised higher, and we may be talking about the first $1 trillion annual deficit. And if you think the federal government's financial situation is tenuous, wait till we see numbers from the state and local governments, which are so dependent on sales and property taxes. California's governor has admitted to a $20 billion budget deficit for the upcoming fiscal year, which is twice as high as his previous forecast, and one-fifth of the state's estimated $101 billion spending plan. Tax increases and spending cutbacks are coming, including layoffs. The California city of Vallejo, population 117,000, recently declared bankruptcy. Even with property taxes up 17% in the prior budget year, Vallejo ran out of cash. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities found that at least 27 states, plus the District of Columbia, are facing an estimated $47 billion in fiscal 2009 state budget shortfalls. New Hampshire's deficit is pegged at $200 million. In Massachusetts, it's $1.2 billion. New Hampshire Governor John Lynch already has instituted freezes on hiring, spending on out-of-state travel, and purchases of equipment. Now Lynch is planning a second round of much deeper cuts to deal with the state's worsening revenue picture. The third and fourth largest segments announcing layoffs this year after financial and government are the transportation and auto sectors. Yesterday, GM disclosed the closure of four plants making trucks and SUVs. GM announced last month that it would shed 19,000 hourly jobs by July the 1st through accepted buyout or early retirement programs. GM also announced yesterday a stunning 30.2% year-over-year decline in U.S. vehicle sales for the month of May, nearly double the year-to-date decline of 17%. Ford's May sales plunged 19%. Ford last month announced big production cuts for the third and fourth quarter and 2,000 more white-collar job reductions. Toyota's sales fell 8% in May, while Chrysler's plummeted 25%. In the first quarter, 16 automotive companies filed for bankruptcy. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I may not really find this surprising that these things are happening. But, you know, frankly, when I see that this idiot Ben Bernanke states, and I quote, despite a recent spike in the nation's unemployment rate, the danger that the economy has fallen into a substantial downturn appears to have waned. I realize that we're just dealing with incompetence. We're just dealing with people who are utterly incompetent. Nobody would dare lie about something as grotesque as that. These people are just ignorant and incompetent. You know, and I read the rest of his comment here. He says, the Fed's powerful doses of interest rate cuts, the government's $168 billion stimulus package, further progress in the repair of problems in financial and credit markets, a gradual ebbing of the drag from the deep housing slump, and still solid demand from abroad for U.S. exports should help the economy over the remainder of this year, he said. I mean, his statements are like standing in front of a tsunami pronouncing the worst is over before the wave has even hit the shore. You know, frankly, before we can say the worst is over or the danger has passed, it would be a really thrilling idea if the storm actually reached the shore first. I mean, you know, we have these future U.S. bank failures, which are yet to come, linked to the downturn in real estate. And according to Sheila Blair, the Federal Deposit and Insurance Corporation, he said that these bank failures may include, quote, institutions of greater size than in the recent past. And this isn't me. This is the representative of the FDIC. Then you have Merrill Lynch, UBS, and Citigroup. They're facing, you know, massive fallout from the downfall of these monolines. AmBank and MBIA that I just mentioned to you have been downgraded. Like by April 2009, hundreds of thousands of option ARM mortgages will be resetting, bringing on a fresh wave of foreclosures. And, you know, if that's not enough, you're going to see a rising unemployment rate. I mean, you're going to see at least 6 or 7% by the end of the year, and frankly, 10 to 15%, in my opinion, between 2009 and 2010. Yet to come, an imploding commercial real estate market, rising junk bond defaults, rising numbers of foreclosures and bankruptcies, rising credit card defaults. The economic picture, ladies and gentlemen, is worsening across the board. And it's not just in the U.S., it's in the U.K. and Europe as well. The housing bust is now underway in the U.K. You know, I mean, it defies credibility to state that the danger has faded. I'm sick and tired of hearing these people, you know, poker-faced, coming on television, standing up in front of an ignorant bunch of nincompoops in Congress and just able to lay it out, and nobody stands up and says anything or criticizes anything that anybody ever says. You know, there's an interesting gentleman called Nicholas Nassim Taleb, who I've mentioned before. He published a book called The Black Swan. And in addition to everything I've mentioned, there is actually a huge risk factor from what might be described as a black swan event. When he published this book, the black swan, it was called The Black Swan, The Impact of the Highly Improbable. It said, you know, among other things, that most economists, almost all bankers, are subhuman and very, very dangerous. They live in a fantasy world in which the future can be controlled by sophisticated mathematical models and elaborate risk management systems. Bankers and economists scorned and raged at Taleb. He didn't understand, they said. A few months later, the full global implications of the subprime-driven credit crunch became clear. The world banking system still teeters on the edge of the meltdown. Taleb had been vindicated, he said. It was my greatest vindication, but to me that wasn't a black swan. It was a white swan. I knew it would happen, and I said so. It is a black swan to Ben Bernanke. I wouldn't use him to drive my car. These guys are dangerous. They're not qualified in their own field. In December, he lectured bankers at the Société Générale, France's second biggest bank. He told them they were sitting on a mountain of risks, a menagerie of black swans. They didn't believe him. 6 weeks later, the rogue trader and black swan, Jérôme Kerviel, landed them with a $7.2 billion worth of losses. So you see, not only is there the risk of the known, there's also the risk of the unknown. Bernanke and that other retard, Henry Paulson, the Secretary of the Treasury, have factored neither into their Pollyannaish statements. Talk from both of them is getting more and more ridiculous by the minute. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, my name again, Richard Martin. This is Richard Martin's wake-up call. Going to give you my information, but before I do that, I would like to read you a piece of mail that came from Josh Manzara, and this is what he has to say, and I would like your feedback on this, ladies and gentlemen. I'm quite new to this business of broadcasting. It's not my forte. I don't really know what I'm doing, but I try to do it anyway. Anyway, he says this, and I'll read you his email. He says, "You spend far, far too much time on giving out your email, phone number, and begging people to call during every show. Just put the contact info on the page where people listen to you. People want to hear you, not your pleading for callers. Just jump into your message like you do on the 6.5 show." I think that's the 5th of June show. Anyway, well, thank you for the input, Josh. I would like to know what you think. See, I don't talk politics on this show because I don't want to irritate people. And if it irritates you to be told my email and the call-in number and my regular number, then I won't do that either. But the thing is, I think we have a lot of new callers, and I have a feeling that they would like to know how they can get in touch with me on the show. And, you know, if I am guilty of pleading for callers, Josh, I mean, I do feel it's important. I like to hear from people. I don't know why. It's just, you know, one of the things I enjoy about this show is the ability to interact with other people. You know, I sit in this office. It's a rather small office, but I sit here doing my job all day long, and I don't really get to talk to many people other than for my clients, which I, of course, enjoy talking to. But as I sit here with the show, it's really nice to be able to actually have some kind of a genuine interaction with people, which is why I wish, you know, more people actually would call. I'd like to know what other people think about that, because if, in fact, it's irritating, I'll just read off the number very quickly and move on. Let's try it today and see how it goes. Okay, here we go. "Hi, my name is Richard Martin. This is Richard Martin's wake-up call. You can call me online right now at 888-873-4643. Give you the number again. It's 888-873-4643. If you'd like to email me, it's rmartin@gscorporation.com. That's GS Global Strategic Corporation, to be written out in full, please. Again, rmartin@gscorporation.com. My personal number is 305-357-5575. That's if you want to call me in private. Okay, well, if that works, more power to you and more power to me. I'm all for it. Okay, Daryl from the Bronx is online. Hi, how are you?
Fine, Richard. How are you doing?
Okay, thanks.
I just wanted to reaffirm that, for new listeners, it's really important that you do exactly what you do, which is give out your contact information, because there are people who don't give that out, and then it makes it challenging to both get in touch with them on air, but more important, getting in touch with them off air. And I've done both, and you've been kind and pleasant and given me information each and every way. So I think that you're doing exactly what a wise broadcaster does, because a wise broadcaster expects their network to expand so that each show should bring new people to the listenership.
Well, thank you very much, Daryl. I appreciate the encouragement. Let's see if I get a couple more pieces of feedback here, because obviously Josh felt very strongly about what he had to say. You know, I have no problem bringing this to the fore. And once we've got this out of the way, then we won't have to talk about it again. But in the meantime, thank you very much for your feedback.
And thank you so much, Richard, for all that you do and how you help us through, especially this challenging piece, as the economy totally, as far as I can tell, it's totally transforming itself. And the people on the standard information cycles are stuck in time and savings and stuff that sometimes doesn't make much sense when you look at what's happening. So thank you for your perspective.
Thanks, Daryl.
Bye-bye, Richard. Bye-bye.
I must say that, it becomes more and more shocking to me, you know, the further we get into this miasma of economic downturn, and how these people just keep their head in the air. I don't know whether they think everybody is stupid. I don't know whether they're stupid. I don't know whether they're lying to us. There are so many inputs that I have no understanding of as to why these people continue to say the same things over and over again. What I think really astonishes me most is that there seems to be nobody other than Ron Paul in Congress who has the slightest idea of what's going on anyway. And I must suppose that this is a tradition in the United States. You know, the United States has had it so easy for so many decades that I think that they just, Americans just assume that everything's going to be okay and that they really don't have to give much importance to economic matters. I have noticed the difference in the years I've spent living in Europe in different countries, how much more importance they seem to give to economic matters. It's in the general newspaper reading section. People just talk about it more than they seem to here. So I don't know whether this will come later, as things get worse, people suddenly wake up and realize that they really have to give to pay attention to what's going on. Only time will tell. But anyway, thank you, Daryl. We have Susan from Washington on the line. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Richard. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
I just wanted to weigh in on that. I don't think it's annoying giving your number. I think it's fine to give your number in the beginning of the show, the number in the email. Excuse me, but I wanted to comment on something that you had said earlier. You said on the one hand that people should try to sell their homes, or if they can't, to walk away from their homes. And then on the other hand, you said don't pile up debt because you will not be forgiven. But if you walk away from your house, you're obviously still liable for the debt. I was wondering if you could talk about that a little bit more and maybe spend some time on a show in the near future talking about what happens when you do walk away from your home, when you know it's not sold for as much as you owe for it, what happens, you know, to a person that does that. And then I also wanted to remind you that you were going to talk more about the former head of the Federal Reserve. You were going to devote some time, I think a specific show to that. I hope I didn't miss that.
No, you didn't. You're absolutely right, and I fully intend to do that, Susan. The problem is that so much comes up in the meantime. You know, so many things happen. Like, you know, right. I've already had to tell you about certain things which are really so important to discuss. I only have an hour, and that just isn't. You know, we're already halfway through, and I haven't even begun to talk about any of the, you know, myriad of things that I had on to discuss. And of course, your calls are priority number one for me, and I need to deal with those as well. So we'll just have to fit this thing in when maybe during a holiday period or something like that. But you're absolutely right. As far as your other question is concerned about what happens to people who walk away, basically, Susan, nothing. I'm even hearing just today I read a story about a family who brazenly walked away from their home and then immediately bought another. Incredible though it may sound.
Was that in California?
I don't remember where it was. Had I known your question was coming up, I would have researched this in more detail. It was early this morning. I was reading through some general stuff, and I just noticed this, and I was quite shocked to read that. But I don't know where it was, but the stigma against walking away has really, I think, evaporated since that segment that they had on 60 Minutes a few weeks ago, where Steve Croft, I think it was talking to a family and he offered the observation that maybe they walked away through what he described as a business decision. They just basically said yes. I mean, basically where corporations every day of the week make business decisions which impact the people, on the other side of the decision, walking away from one's home was described and was posited as a business decision, in which case, of course, the people who walk away are not normally involved because they don't have any money. They simply don't have. Nobody walks away from their home in general unless they really don't have the ability to pay. What I have suggested is that if that situation should appear to be looming on the horizon, you should walk away anyway, because the choice is very simple. Either you sign up for a lifetime of debt servitude, paying over a period of time far in excess of that for which you signed up originally, or else you walk away and start to make a fresh life for yourself. If you walk away, it is indeed the banks that will have to eat the loss, and they do eat the loss. And, of course, as we know, that filters down through into the derivatives, and this is what's going to bring the whole system down in the end. And we know that. But there are really no ramifications to speak of, Susan. And you know, you do what you have to do, and that's kind of the end of it. I'm only here to tell you to do that, to give you, as it were, the sort of moral justification for doing that. I can't give you the economic justification in terms of each individual person's finances, because only they know what they are. But in a general sense, if you're looking for support for the concept of walking away from the home, you have it coming from me right here. So thanks for the question, Susan. Now we have Frank from New Jersey on the line. Hi, Frank. How are you?
Hi, Richard. I'm doing well. Thank you. Just wanted to say that I think it's a very good idea to give out your information as you do, and to echo Daryl, and to thank you for sharing so much with us. As far as the situation with the current administration refusing to accept reality, it reminds me of a quote from James Howard Kunstler, which I think sums it up. It goes something like this: when people refuse to accept what the world is sending them, they get appointed a new negotiating partner. It's called reality. I think the only factor here is time. None of them will be able to do anything in the face of the ensuing financial tsunami, as you called it, and it'll be very interesting to see the apologies or the resignations, one or the other, at that time.
Yep. Well, either resignations or basically just failure to be re-elected. I mean, one way or another, these people will pass into history. They will be forgotten, or they will be remembered for the fools they were, like the famous case I'd mentioned before of Irving Fisher, the greatest living economist of the 1920s, the most prestigious economist that the world had ever known. He was famous worldwide, and he said 5 weeks before the market started to collapse in 1930, thereby losing 85% of its value, that we were on a permanent plateau of prosperity, and that there would be no further recession, and that American business would proceed apace. Well, he wasn't lying. I mean, the guy was saying what he genuinely thought, but they have a blind spot, or they're just not really equipped to make those kind of judgments, and those judgments are expected of them. So one way or another, then obviously, one has to live with the consequences, because these are the people who have power over our lives. They make the laws. They make the rules by which, we have to live. So, they're not just people who are, as Bernanke was, professors at a dusty old Ivy League, a university in Princeton, New Jersey. So, not a million miles, I guess, from where you are right now, Frank. Oh, and by the way, Frank, I hope you got my email back about the archives. Everybody, I know we've been having some problems with these archives. It's sort of intermittent. They come and go. Just keep trying. They were okay this morning. They were down yesterday. Apparently they were down when Frank emailed me earlier on to say that there was a strange message coming up about bandwidth or something, but they should be okay. And I did inform the person at PRN who deals with the archives for the shows. So, okay, I get now. I just see, and I am from Eric, our tech engineer, who said we're having problems because it's costing us a lot of money for bandwidth. Well, I sympathize very much with that. PRN is a service that is provided free of charge, and I guess it's hard to keep up. So please, have patience and sympathize with the predicament. Kevin Frenzel, I have an email from you, and Kevin says, comment, your program is so excellent that it is a bit of a distraction and somewhat disruptive to give the contact information more than once or to repeat it. That is what commercial broadcasters do. It would not surprise me that you get more email as the program is on the Internet. So if I understand correctly, from your email, Kevin, you would prefer me to sort of hurry it along a bit and just get it over and done with. If that's not the case, perhaps you could just email me and correct me, but I do feel that that's what you're trying to tell me here, and I definitely get the message. And I do obviously get email as well, as you rightly point out, but nothing really replaces the live interaction between us on the show. And then you add a question. What are the five best economic or financial business model books written for the lay public? I've got to think about that one. Kevin, you say, Mind Might Be Fooled by Randomness, The Black Swan, Conspiracy of Fools, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and When Genius Failed, The Rise and Fall of LTCM, that's Long-Term Capital Management, written by Roger Lowenstein. All good books that I know of. I've read Fooled by Randomness and The Black Swan. I have not read The Conspiracy of Fools. I have watched an interview on TV by the author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and I have read parts of When Genius Failed, and I haven't finished it, I must confess. I need to do that. Thank you, Kevin. Good advice there. All right. I'm going to do something a little different now, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to read you a fairy tale about the American dream. And this comes by courtesy of Laura Rowley. So, sit back and enjoy yourselves and try to stomach my rendition as best you can. Here we go. Once upon a time, there was a greedy young man with shiny wingtips and important degrees. His father, an advisor to the king, had paid the young man's way through an Ivy League college and got him a job managing the village's pension investments. The greedy young man went to his magic mirror and said, "Mirror, mirror, I'm at the top of my field. I'm entitled to a higher yield. I'd like to earn that yield today so I get a bonus with my pay. Tell me now, because here's the thing. I'm really entitled to earn more than the king." The mirror replied, "Call Wall Street, please, and invest in mortgage-backed securities. Don't worry whether the yield will last. This way you'll get your bonus fast." And the greedy young man went on television, where the media declared him a genius. The investment banker. Once upon a time, there was a greedy investment banker with shiny high heels and important Ivy League degrees. She went to her magic mirror and said, "Mirror, mirror, on the wall, I'm clearly entitled to a windfall. I'm putting upon you the onus. What's the best way to boost my bonus?" The mirror replied, "Here you'll find the recipe. Sell this hot security. Bundle good and bad mortgages together, slice and dice them, and sell them as treasure. Don't worry about what's really inside. Anything foul the rating agencies can hide. If you follow my advice today, surely you'll increase your rate of pay." And the greedy investment banker went on television, where the media declared her a genius. The bank president. Once upon a time, there was a greedy bank president with a fancy gold watch and important degrees. He went to his magic mirror and said, "I find myself on the executive floor. I'm really entitled to be earning more. If the stock went up, I'd have no cares, since I own about 1 million shares. 10 other banks have opened on my block. Tell me how to boost my stock." The mirror replied, "Hand out mortgages across the land and sell them to Wall Street as fast as you can. Heed my word in this endeavor, and your stock will go up and up forever." And the greedy bank president went on television, where the media declared that his bank's stock would likely go up forever. The mortgage broker. Once upon a time, there was a greedy young man with a not-so-fancy degree and a leased Porsche. He went to his magic mirror and said, "Mirror, mirror, I want to be rich. Tell me where I can find my niche. I've read The Secret, and I'm ready for action. I'm familiar with the laws of attraction. My ambition is so thoroughly unbridled, I think you'll agree that I'm entitled." The mirror replied, "Now, my friend, don't fret or frown, but make some loans with no money down. Become a mortgage broker and get on the phone. Get some expertise in the liar loan. Find suckers with no income to sign on the line. Tell them when the rate adjusts, things will be fine. Or sign yourself, who needs permission? Just make sure the loan has the biggest commission. Since you're lending the bank's money, there's no hitch. Just close those loans and you'll be rich." And the mortgage broker went on television, where he starred in a commercial as Crazy Morty the Mortgage Broker, urging would-be homeowners to call him at 1-800-555-4567. The greedy townsperson. Once upon a time, there was a greedy townsperson who lived in his parents' basement and spent most of his time watching television. He saw the mortgage broker's commercial, went to his magic mirror and said, "I don't have a job or a fancy degree, but I'm smarter than those geniuses on TV, and I'm entitled to a home for free. Should I call the number that I see?" And the mirror replied, "Yes, and then cash out your equity." He bought a McMansion and 6 months later cashed out the equity and bought a Lexus. The hard-working townsperson. Once upon a time, there was a hard-working townsperson, the neighbor of the man who bought the McMansion. The hard-working man toiled in IT for the bank, where he received raises of 4% a year. Unfortunately, his expenses, food, gas, utilities, taxes, health insurance, college tuition, even the cleats for his kid's soccer shoes, were rising much faster. He drove an 8-year-old minivan and had scrimped and saved to buy a house he could afford, even putting 20% down. He went to his magic mirror and said, "Mirror, mirror, I'm exhausted. Today at work, I almost lost it. I came home from my toil and fell into bed. What can I do to get ahead?" And the mirror replied, "I have no schemes for such an honest dude. I sincerely hope you don't get screwed." The moral. As it turned out, the mortgage-backed securities were not treasure, and the pension fund went broke. The king made up for the loss by doubling taxes. The greedy young man and the greedy investment banker both got lucrative new jobs at a hedge fund run by an Ivy League pal. The bank stock didn't go up forever. It crashed to $5 a share. But the bank president received a bailout worth $160 million and retired to the Caribbean. The mortgage broker moved to the Caribbean as well, where he was recognized by the banker who had enjoyed his Crazy Morty TV commercials. The banker got him a job running the country club's caddy shack. The townsperson who bought the McMansion couldn't afford his mortgage when the rate reset, so the government bailed him out. The hard-working townsperson was laid off with no severance. That money had been given to the bank president. The hard-working townsperson's home plunged in value and his taxes went up to bail out his neighbor and the kingdom's pension fund. His IT job was sent overseas, where the bank hired a programmer for $8,000 a year. And the mirror just sighed at all the trouble. Another mania, another bubble. The winners get out before it bursts. The man who follows the rules is cursed. With a sense of entitlement and plenty of greed, you can win this game with lightning speed. I've told the tale, and now I'm finished. And the American dream was greatly diminished. Well, thank you very much, Laura. That was a pleasure to read, and I hope it was as much of a pleasure to listen to. And I just get an email from Steve Kruger, who says, Richard, excellent, truly a grim fairy tale. Totally agreed, Steve. I actually couldn't agree more. All right. So we have now, while I've been reading this, looks like two more emails. One is from DC, who states, RM, you are correct when you say that speculators do not care which way the market goes. I am a stock speculator, and it makes no matter to me. I am making a good profit going short and long, DC. Well, there you go. It's a pity that there is actually so much ignorance about this question of speculation. It's very strange. Unfortunately, the people who criticize speculators have got it completely round the wrong way. What the people that they should be criticizing are people who actually have power in as much as they own the specific commodity that may be going up in value, that they either withhold from the market or else whose price, you know, they gouge for the purpose of making extra profit at other people's expense. But not the speculators. The speculators really are, in my opinion, fairly innocent in that regard. I get an email from Gary Wagner about the sound quality. Hi, Richard. I wish you would get a better connection, perhaps a digital line for the broadcast. It's hard to hear. Sorry to hear that, Gary. I wonder if anybody else here. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm back with you. I'm sorry. It seems that all of the lines in the office where I work are out. And basically, I am talking to you through my cell phone right now. I'm watching the IM here very carefully so that if you can't hear me, I will be informed. I'm not at all sure where I was when we got cut off. But I think I was referring to an email that I had got from Cliff, and I will read that email to you. It was from Cliff, who said, Richard, share the contact info. I'm a long-time listener, and it doesn't bother me at all. Tell Josh it's not all about him or his comfort only, and give others a chance to contact and discover you. You are sharing information that is vitally important, and the more people who find out and contact you with their economic concerns, the better. Yours is a wonderful program. I love it. My only suggestion for now is perhaps you can devote more time, perhaps towards the end of your program, of positive ways of dealing with the financial horrors upon us or will be upon us. It's so much bad news, which we need to hear, but we also need to have good info and tools to be empowered. Every show should have at least 10 to 15 minutes giving us ideas to avoid being victims or transcend being victims if we become one. Specific ideas, tools, method, procedures would be great, including books that show us how. Signed, Cliff. Well, Cliff, I get it, what you say, and I would be more than happy to give you information. Basically, it is a question, obviously, of time. Time is not very, we are not generous with time. Life goes by and, you know, there is just so much to say. But in answer to that, I am going to give you some information courtesy of Joe Carroll, who forwarded this to me, and it is tips on pumping gas. And I thought I might share this with you. And hopefully this will go some way to responding to your concern here. This is tips on pumping gas in an era of high gas prices, and this is the information. I don't know what you guys are paying for gasoline, but in California we are paying up to $3.75 to $4.10 a gallon. My line of work is in petroleum for about 31 years now, so here are some tricks to get more of your money's worth for every gallon. Here at the Kinder Morgan pipeline, where I work in San Jose, California, we deliver about 4 million gallons in a 24-hour period through the pipeline. One day is diesel, the next day is jet fuel and gasoline, regular and premium grades. We have 34 storage tanks here with a total capacity of 16,800,000 gallons. Only buy or fill up your car or truck in the early morning when the ground temperature is still cold. Remember that all service stations have their storage tanks buried below ground. The colder the ground, the more dense the gasoline. When it gets warmer, gasoline expands, so buying in the afternoon or in the evening, your gallon is not exactly a gallon. In the petroleum business, the specific gravity and the temperature of the gasoline, diesel and jet fuel, ethanol, and other petroleum products plays an important role. A 1 degree rise in temperature is a big deal for this business. But the service stations do not have temperature compensation at the pumps. When you're filling up, do not squeeze the trigger of the nozzle to a fast mode. If you look, you will see that the trigger has three stages, low, middle, and high. You should be pumping on low mode, thereby minimizing the vapors that are created while you are pumping. All hoses at the pump have a vapor return. If you are pumping on the fast rate, some of the liquid that goes to your tank becomes vapor. Those vapors are being sucked up and back into the underground storage tank, so you're getting less worth for your money. One of the most important tips is to fill up when your gas tank is half full. The reason for this is the more gas you have in your tank, the less air occupying its empty space. Gasoline evaporates faster than you can imagine. Gasoline storage tanks have an internal floating roof. This roof serves as zero clearance between the gas and the atmosphere, so it minimizes the evaporation. Unlike service stations here where I work, every truck that we load is temperature compensated so that every gallon is actually the exact amount. Another reminder, if there is a gasoline truck pumping into the storage tanks when you stop to buy gas, do not fill up. Most likely the gasoline is being stirred up as the gas is being delivered, and you might pick up some of the dirt that normally settles on the bottom. Well, there we are, ladies and gentlemen. I hope that was useful to you. Follow the advice and get more bang for your buck. Well, we have 3 minutes, and I will just like to inform you that the BIS, that's the Bank for International Settlements, the organization that fosters cooperation between central banks, has warned that the credit crisis could lead world economies into a crash on a scale not seen since the 1930s. Ben Bernanke, are you listening? In its latest quarterly report, the body points out that the Great Depression of the 1930s was not foreseen, and that commentators on the financial turmoil initiated by the U.S. subprime mortgage crisis may not have grasped the level of exposure that lies at its heart. According to the BIS, complex credit instruments, a strong appetite for risk, rising levels of household debt, and long-term imbalances in the world currency system all form part of the loose monetarist policy that could result in another Great Depression. The report points out between March and May of this year, interbank lending continued to show signs of extreme stress, and this could be set to continue well into the future. It also raises concerns about the Chinese economy and questions whether China may be repeating mistakes made by Japan with its so-called bubble economy of the late 1980s. Well, the only thing I would say there is that to say that the Great Depression of the 1930s was not foreseen is frankly an outright lie. And an interesting quote from Charles Lindbergh Sr. in 1913, who said as follows, "This Federal Reserve Act," this was the act that created the Federal Reserve, "establishes the most gigantic trust on earth. When the President, Wilson, signs this bill, the invisible government of the monetary power will be legalized. The worst legislative crime of the ages is perpetrated by this banking and currency bill. From now on, depressions will be scientifically created." Well, The Bank for International Settlement should know, ladies and gentlemen, as a central bank for the central bank, one would think that they have a cozy insider's view of things. You know, these central banking cabals are really leading the world to financial ruin. The U.S. Financial Reserve has done nothing but loot the treasury, siphon off the nation's wealth, caused working people to take on massive debt, and exacerbate the boom and bust financial cycles. So there you have it. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm terribly sorry about the snafu we had just now, but let me anyway wish you a very nice and happy and relaxing weekend, and I'll be back with you again Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Richard Martin from Richard Martin's Wake Up Call saying bye-bye. See you soon.